With the end of the fighting in Afghanistan in 1989, bin Laden returned to Saudi Arabia and his family's firm, while al-Qaeda remained in its camps in Afghanistan and its guest houses in Pakistan. The withdrawal of the Soviets may have been a crowning achievement, but the various factions of Mujahideen still refused to overcome their differences as they fought on fractiously against the Soviet-installed regime in Kabul that was led by the former secret police chief Najibullah. Bin Laden was fed up. Saudi Arabia was in many regards no more satisfying. The returning soldier who finds himself at odds with the society at home is a cliché, but for bin Laden, it had a powerful truth. Those who had fought a holy war came home to no fanfare and little appreciation. After August 1, 1990, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, bin Laden's disaffection turned to disgust. The takeover and the menacing of Saudi Arabia by the Iraqi army precipitated the worst crisis in the country's history. An oft-reported story tells of bin Laden offering to put his Afghan Arabs at the disposal of the Saudi government to defend the country against Saddam Hussein, who, to jihadists, represented the worst kind of Muslim, a blaspheming arch-nationalist. The government declined, instead putting itself in the hands of the U.S. military. The first plane loads of GIs arrived in the kingdom on August the 7th. Stirred by the shock of American troops arriving in the kingdom, bin Laden's ideas about the future of al-Qaeda began to evolve. At the time, he believed that his business in Afghanistan was finished. His determination to overthrow secular regimes was strengthening, as was his anger about American inroads into the Islamic world. He wanted to be more active and to move his forces from the far reaches of Afghanistan closer to the Arab world, where they might exert more influence on events. But the region was virtually filled with inhospitable nationalist governments, all of which were showing their anxiety about returning jihadists by harassing and imprisoning them. The sole exception was Sudan, where a 1989 coup had brought a hybrid military-Islamist regime to power. Even before that takeover, Islamists had been more successful in Sudan than in any other predominantly Sunni country. That record was the accomplishment of a Sorbonne-educated scholar, Hassan al-Turabi, one of the world's leading Islamist thinkers and a one-time dean of the University of Khartoum Law School. As the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan in the 1960s, al-Turabi engineered the group's metamorphosis into a political party, the National Islamic Front. The NIF had managed to join the government of the strongman Ghaffar Nimeiri in 1977, with al-Turabi as Attorney General. Using that position and Nimeiri's own turn to religion, al-Turabi pushed through a reform of Sudanese law along the lines of Sharia, built up his political base, and established contacts with Islamists throughout the Maghreb, Egypt, Jordan, and the Gulf states. Nimeiri and his government were ousted in 1985, and the NIF's fortunes declined in the latter half of the decade. Determined to reverse the slide, al-Turabi and a military officer, Brigadier General Omar Bashir, engineered the coup that deposed Sudan's moderate government. Al-Turabi envisioned turning Sudan into the center of the Islamist movement, stealing the banner of Islamic leadership from Saudi Arabia, and providing a base for groups that would bring Sharia governments to power. After the coup, Sudan flung the doors open to extremist groups from all over. Al-Qaeda began to ponder relocation to the new center of world Islamism. Bin Laden's decision to move to Sudan was a boon to the ideological ambitions of the regime in Khartoum. It promised an economic shot in the arm as well. Because of its support for Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War, Sudan was short on friends and funds. Bin Laden's personal finances are a continuing mystery, but he clearly came to Sudan with a substantial amount of cash. His inheritance probably amounted to some $30 million, and he may have had more money at his disposal from wealthy donors in the Persian Gulf. His investments in his new home suggest that he was delivering a quid pro quo for the safe haven his group received, but he may also genuinely have shared al-Turabi's hopes for creating a thriving, Islamically pure country.